Committee on Business and Transportations. We got a number of reports and very interesting stuff, I think, on the agenda today. We're going to start off first with a report from the Governor's Transportation Vision Panel. And Patrick, you have any intro?
Mr. Chair, the Vision Panel wrapped up its work a couple months ago, I believe, and just issued its report last week, and so they're here to talk about that. One of the co-chairs of the report and the staff who provided the primary staff support.
Oh, post date.
Well, I'm sure you know very well, so.
Mr. Chair, just note for the record that I read the wrong date off here. It's the 24th, not the 18th. Supposed to date. That's what happens when you just read the agenda.
Just behind the times.
All righty. So, Mr. Cantor, Carmen, are you going to join, or are you going to let Sam do it? Well, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Pleasure to be here and to have a few minutes to talk you through our report. I've got Sam Hafner from ODOT with me, who's going to, I think, drive. I'm going to just navigate the presentation a little bit, and I would offer to the chair here that since you were a member of the panel, to fill in the blanks and anything I miss, feel free to interrupt me. Obviously, our report was a product of a panel that consisted of a broad base of membership, political leaders such as Chairman Beyer, a number of other state senators, including Betsy Johnson, Jackie Winters, and former senators Starr and Verger. Also business and civic leaders from around the state, a fairly diverse set of folks. And if you look at the next slide there, our mission, I'll go through very quickly, was really to assess the challenges and the opportunities facing our transportation system, the conditions of it, and then identify actions that could be taken in the near term. And really the focus was on the near term, the next 48 months, next 4 years. But in doing that, we were asked to also look at a vision for the next 30 years, to put those actions in context of a larger vision for the transportation system. And then also really the mission that we were given was to focus in on congestion issues, but also on seismic vulnerability, and we did just that, as you'll see in a moment. Our process, we were created by Governor Kitzhaber in November of 2014. We got started with a number of meetings with the full spectrum of transportation stakeholders, from transit to rail to trucks to pedestrians to bikes. You know, we met with just about every group that exists out there in terms of the transportation interests. We began work on some initial issue assessments in January through November. We took a bit of a break when we had a change in our governor, and then we were reconstituted and recharged by Governor Brown after she came in the spring summertime of 2015. We completed our initial issues assessment and develop some preliminary findings by December of 2015. And then from January through March of this year, we took those findings out, traveled the state, met with the area commissions on transportation in 11 meetings, essentially in all parts of the state. And over the last couple of months, we've been finalizing report, and on May 17th, we submitted it to the governor. You'll see that the report is titled One Oregon. You may ask why that title, and I will tell you it's never easy naming a report. But I think, as you'll sense from some of my remarks in a few minutes, it's designed to recognize the fact that while we may be a very diverse state, there are a lot of things that make us One Oregon, and one very important part of that piece that connects us as One Oregon is our transportation system. Without it, we aren't One Oregon, and it makes it much more difficult to be One Oregon, and that's the purpose of that title. This next slide shows you the areas that we met, had our public meetings in. They were fascinating meetings. We went through our initial findings with each group. We asked them to talk to us about the transportation issues in their area, how those transportation issues were affecting life in their communities, but also their economic viability and vitality. And in this report, I won't go over them today, but in this report, you'll have very, very detailed issues assessments on each region of the state, and I encourage you to take a look at that. And I know the joint committee that's being put together is going to go back out over the next rest of this year and talk in the community, and I think that might be a good primer for some of those meetings. There was clearly, far and away, one issue that comes up first in any area that you go to with people who understand transportation, who have been involved in or connected to it in a meaningful way, and that is around the lack of dollars for simple maintenance and preservation. The system does not, our investment mechanisms do not put enough money in this system to maintain and preserve what we have today. We're seeing deterioration of our infrastructure, and the more that goes on, the more expensive it gets to get our infrastructure back to a place where we can use it efficiently and affordably. But what I want to focus on about area meetings were really three issues that were somewhat surprising in how common they were across the state. Again, for me, I'm not somebody who's been actively involved in transportation issues for a long period of time, so my eyes were kind of fresh to this. But what surprised me when you ask people, we talked in each region about congestion, and we asked those areas to identify their major congestion problems. And no matter where you went, Central Oregon, Southern Oregon, the Valley, Eastern Oregon, no matter where you went, what came back was our number one congestion issue is getting people and product to and through Portland, Oregon. And I think when you talk about one Oregon, that is one of those uniting problems of one Oregon, is the congestion issues that face people getting their products and people into and out of the Portland metropolitan area. Now, they have their own local congestion issues, bridges and roadways that are in their communities, but I will tell you, they put that Portland congestion issue high on their list of congestion. No matter where we went across the state, transit came up as a huge issue. The lack of funding for transit was the primary concern. And it differed in its context whether you were in a rural community or a larger urban community, but it was about transit. In rural Oregon and rural communities, it was more about intercity transit, taking care of folks who are older, seniors, citizens that just don't have, they're traveling long distances, don't have the ability to pay for or have the capacity to drive, and transit was, you know, a major issue. In urban areas, it's the commute, it's students, it's, you know, the usual issues. And what became apparent as we talked to people is that, you know, they don't have, particularly at the local level, the mechanisms, the financial mechanisms to match federal funds, state funds, and we're leaving money on the table when it comes to what's available from the federal government. The third issue that was common across the state was a recognition of the importance of being ready for a large seismic event, and a recognition, whether you're on the west side of the Cascades or the east side of the Cascades, that this is going to be, if you have an event, it's going to be an impactful of the entire state. Central Oregon understood that in an event, 97 was going to probably begin to serve as a major arterial for recovery of the state of Oregon, and they pointed to, look, we need investments in 97 if you're going to be ready to recover in Portland. Product isn't going to go up by 5. It's going to go up 97 in, you know, generators and things you need in the west side of the state to survive in those months after an earthquake are going to be coming out 97 and being mobilized in Central Oregon before it comes to the valley. Fascinating finding, I think, that everybody's highly attuned to this issue. There's been enough media about the likeliness of a seismic event, and people are digesting and understanding what their role would be. So, in summarizing, I think some of the challenges that we face, you can see them up on that screen. You know, we've got the needs of an aging population, aging transportation infrastructure, greenhouse gas emissions, growing population, seismic vulnerability. All of these are playing a role in what the future of our transportation system needs to look like. On the next slide, we've got a little bit of our vision. There isn't anything, you know, hugely miraculous in this vision. I think the Oregon Transportation Plan has a lot of this, but it is really about making sure that by 2045 our transportation system is in good repair, it's resilient, it's financially stable, and it's meeting the needs of our people and our economy, that is supporting healthy and livable Oregon communities and enhancing mobility, not just through single occupancy vehicles, but across the spectrum of modes. And then that it is providing an efficient multimodal freight network that it's allowing Oregon's businesses to succeed in a nationally and internationally. That it's meeting our greenhouse gas goals. The transportation system in Oregon is responsible for almost 40% of the greenhouse gases emitted in the state. It is going to be a major player in our state's ability to reduce its carbon footprint. And finally, that there is common sense jurisdictional control over the transportation system between the state and local entities, and I'll come back to that as I talk about some of our findings. So as we get to the findings, first and foremost, again, is that we aren't meeting the need financially to maintain and preserve the infrastructure that we currently have. And number one, we've got to find a way to get those dollars injected into the system in a way that lets us catch up and stay at least in a mode of preserving what we already have. And the costs of not doing that are going to be substantial if we let this system deteriorate further. On bottlenecks, we got too many of them to do them all. We have to be very strategic about those bottlenecks. We got to identify the top 5 or 10. We need to begin investing in eliminating those bottlenecks. And sometimes it's not just about investing in the roadways themselves. Sometimes where the bottleneck is, but to think strategically about how to move traffic around to other areas. We need, for example, to identify alternative freight networks like 97, like Highway 30, and make investments in those that can relieve congestion on I-5, 84, 405, 205 to get at that Portland area congestion problem. And we need to look at demand management areas as well. On transit, it was really the committee believes we have to find more dollars at the state level, but not just at the state level. We also have to provide local communities, cities and counties, the tools, the financial tools to be able to invest in transit dollars, particularly to be able to capture those federal funds that are sitting on the table that we're letting pass by because of that. And we have to look at the way we're transporting our children to school. Those yellow buses, they're in rural areas. Those buses can be used for other things during the day. In urban areas, we have to look at the transit systems that exist and ask ourselves, are those yellow buses duplicating something that could be done more efficiently through our existing transit systems? Bikes and pedestrians. I will also tell you, no matter where you go in this state, the issues of bike and pedestrians come up. Pedestrians, clearly, there are more people walking than ever before. It is a safety issue. We heard in Eugene, for example, we heard from mothers who had lost their children to traffic crashes who were walking on the side of the road or playing on the side of the road. Just, you know, you've got high high occupancy, high speed roadways that are now, that weren't there before, that have appeared essentially, and neighborhoods that have built around them that are putting people in danger, that aren't creating safe pathways to schools, to work, and other places. On bikes, the same is true. We've got increasing bike users. Not just in Portland. I was fascinated to hear along the coast the importance of bike as tourism in Central Oregon is bikes as tourism, and the importance of separating those bikes from high-speed roadways, both for tourism in Central Oregon, concern on the coastal counties around, particularly in the fall when you have bikes on these very small rural roads and you've got harvesting equipment on the roads, that the conflict there is dangerous. And yet they understand the importance of tourism and bike tourism these days, and they want to figure out a way to invest in that as well. On intermodal freight infrastructure, I think the conclusion from the panel really is that every piece of product produced in Oregon doesn't need to come to Portland or through Portland by truck. We have a lot more assets than that, from marine assets, rail assets, aviation. We have to get more strategic about how we're moving freight around our state. We talked about, looked at intermodal facilities, transload facilities, where it comes by truck to a place where it gets put on rail that goes to Portland. There's some great examples of how our ports like Newport, Coos Bay can be used as barging, you know, trucks go there, barge traffic through Portland to Portland or through Portland to the Puget Sound area. What's clear is that each port has its own strategic plan. They look at what they're trying to achieve. The state does not have a comprehensive integrated marine strategic plan, and we believe one needs to be produced to make sure we're optimizing all the assets of the state as we go forward and move freight around. Then on seismic resiliency, there is a terrific seismic plan that was produced in 2014 called
Seismic Plus
plan. It is primarily a roadway strategy. It includes 97 and what the alternative roadway system will look like in the aftermath of a seismic event, and it is an investment strategy around that. That plan needs to be coordinated with Washington and California to make sure they fit together. We need to invest in that plan in the infrastructure that it has identified, and we probably need some sort of sustained investment on a regular basis year after year to deal with the roadways and the bridges that have been identified as real vulnerabilities for the state. We also need to do some assessments. While there's been a high-level state assessment of primarily roads there and bridges, there really hasn't been a local assessment done of the vulnerabilities in the communities and counties. That needs to be done, and there is also an assessment that's needed in terms of marine, rail, and aviation as well, and how those will play and fit together in the aftermath of a seismic event. On jurisdictional transfers, big issue, tough issue, one the state's been talking about for a long period of time. The fact that you've got urban roadways that have now become of statewide importance, and you've got state highways that have really become subsumed by urban communities and are now really urban pathways, and yet we haven't figured out how to transfer those assets to the right jurisdiction. There are financial issues involved. We recommended a pilot program to demonstrate that it can be done, to take a first step forward, and I think doing that can really improve the efficiency of the maintenance and preservation dollars that we do put into the system. On innovation, there was a fascinating set of meetings from scientists, experts in the transportation field who are involved in innovation on connected cars, automated vehicles, drones, across the board. And I'd say The findings from all of that are a couple. One, that it's developing faster than people would think. That this isn't, these developments aren't 20 years out. They're 5 years. They're 10 years out. And they have an amazing capacity to improve our transportation system, reduce greenhouse gases, actually help improve capacity on existing roadways. Some really important opportunities there for our transportation system. And the panel concluded that, this is Oregon. We are innovators. There is no reason why this state shouldn't be at the forefront of testing these new technologies. And in fact, Portland right now is in the running amongst, I think, three or four cities that for a smart grid in the Portland area, a $50 million federal grant. We need to be on the forefront. It fits our DNA. The panel recommended that we create a chief innovation officer in the executive branch that reaches out, because what this is going to take is partnerships between the public and private sector, and begins to organize state government and the private sector to create these public-private partnerships that put us on the cutting edge. The greenhouse gas emissions, clearly a very important part of this transportation system is how it evolves over time to reduce its carbon footprint. We recommended that if you're not, and concluded that if you're not tracking, you'll never know what happens. We have proposed that a small office, be created in state government to do carbon accounting, to make sure, not just on the transportation side, but also on the energy side, that we're hitting our targets, that we're measuring the impact of actions that we are taking. Led a company in the energy environment that is very concerned about carbon, I've come to appreciate how complex carbon accounting is. And there are national experts, it turns out, on carbon accounting right here in Oregon, one that we use out of Eugene, that ought to be engaged in the state effort to track and monitor what we're doing in the way of reducing carbon emissions from the transportation system. And finally, on land use, obviously the interconnection between land use and transportation policy is close. It's important. It's critical as you look longer term down the road. And we've suggested that an effort be made to bring together the Oregon Transportation Commission and LCDC to make sure that the policies we have in place are optimizing land use and transportation, that they fit together, they're aligned, and they're achieving the goals that we have for not just land use, but for transportation. We've recommended that they come together on a periodic basis to assess those policies and the integration of those policies. So having said all that, I'll finish just with a little bit on the finance side of this. The challenges, as you can see, are on the finance. We've got lots of deferred maintenance. We lack, many of the funding sources that other states have. Other states have funding problems, but they also have more tools at their disposal. I think in Oregon, our cities and counties face a huge issue when it comes to lack of tools. The cities and counties face it in spades, and the investments that are needed there are enormous. We really, because of the constitutional tie of the state roadway funds to highways, we really don't have effective ways of investing in marine, rail, and aviation. That needs to be looked at and changed. Existing, we don't index our funding. It's being eroded by inflation, and it's also being eroded by innovation. As you see, higher mile per hour or mile per gallon vehicles, electric vehicles, natural gas vehicles, the funding going into the road fund is being reduced and stressed. What we see around the state is that we are using federal funds primarily for expansion projects, and because we're not maintaining what we've got. So if there is expansion going on, it's generally from federal funds. That isn't that isn't going to get us to the end where we need to be, that we need to figure out a way for the state to invest in the expansion of our system, not just roads, but across the modes. And I'd say, you know, from a group of people that got pretty deep into all of this, there is a belief that we are at a time in our state's history where we just have to act, that there is a call to action here that is urgent and immediate, and if we don't take it up, that we face serious economic consequences from that. What you'll see on the next slides and in the back of the report is a menu of financial options. Nothing in them is particularly miraculous or new, but it is a strong list of potential items for raising revenue for our transportation system. We tried to do a couple of things. One, to rank them across a number of attributes from the efficiency of collection to the equity, and it's a pretty interesting matrix that I think ranks some of them in terms of a lot of attributes that you as our policymakers I think should be helpful. The other thing that we tried to do, and then I'll be quiet and open it up for questions. The other thing we tried to do is to give a sense of scale, what it would take to make a meaningful or substantial contribution to the issues that we faced. And you can see them on this slide, you know, over $300 million a year in maintenance and preservation, $250 million a year in seismic resiliency, $250 million in reducing bottlenecks, $100 million in transit, $25 million in bike. I mean, these are give you a sense of scale. These are large numbers, recognize that. But these are the kind of numbers that really will change the landscape, will change Oregon, will change our economy, will change how we move people around in very substantial ways. And if you know, look out 2 years, 4 years, 30 years, you would, with these kinds of investments, you're going to see a change in the landscape and a change in Oregon. And with that, I'll be quiet and entertain any questions or comments from Senator Beyer, who also served on this.
So the picture there is this: if we really want to do the job, it's about $1 billion a year more.
Yeah, that wouldn't be a bad number.
Ouch.
Again, recognize the it's such a big bite. And I think our charge really was, if you have another dollar, so you think you can think about big numbers, but I think we tried as the committee to really say, if you had another dollar, where would you invest that next dollar? And this tries to provide a blueprint for that.
So a couple of comments and a question. One, I think the funding constraints is obviously that's the big bugaboo for us dealing with this. And one of the growing problems that concerns me is we've had to date a really good state-local balance with the way we share the revenues that are raised and ensure that you have the so-called level playing field across the state in terms of no gas station is intentionally priced higher than another as you go there. I think we're starting to lose that a little bit. Portland just passed a 10-cent gas tax. There are a couple other states that have passed that. A number of cities have passed property tax levies. A number of them have done other measures trying to get there. One of my fears in terms of that, and just to be very honest, is you can do that in a largely populated metro area or some of the bigger cities, but what we lose with that is the rural areas are never going to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And so they're going to be the losers. And to the extent that I think we do that, you know, the Portland tax bothers me a lot because it's sort of, you know, now I have to ask Portland legislators to try and add on top of that.
Exactly.
And I think that makes it an even tougher vote. And the comment could easily be, well, you know, state didn't do anything. We took care of our own. You're on your own, everybody else. And that really gets at a problem of maintaining a statewide network. So that's an issue that we're going to have to deal with. The so-called orphan roads is one. I think one of the problems the state transportation system has had is we have trouble prioritizing our roads. The last governor to really look at that, frankly, was Governor Goldschmidt. who I remember him very distinctly saying, we can't afford to do everything. We have to select some things and make those work really well, and the rest of them will just have to catch up. And I think for local communities, that's going to be, you know, whether you're looking at 82nd in Portland or, you know, Main Street in Springfield, sort of like you want to maintain that. That's not a state priority anymore.
Yeah.
We'll give you the option to take that over. And how we get to there, I know the mantra, because I've heard it a lot when I was on city council and others, is the local public works directors are saying, we'll take it over, you fix it first. And that's a hard thing to do, but I think that's a discussion we need to have. I do get a kick. Everybody's looking at innovation is going to solve the problems, but the recent reports in the last couple of weeks that come out said, actually what automated cars may do is deal with the capacity better because you can push people closer together, which is probably good if you have an automated car that's really working, but not so good as the Google car experiences. The Google car has never had a wreck when the computer was driving. What they have is they got stuck at intersections because they're waiting for the other people to do the right thing. I think that kind of problem is there. And the other side is the forecast now is that actually it will increase the number of people and the number of cars on the road, not decrease it, because people who can't drive now will all of a sudden be riding the Uber car or something. So I think that's a mixed thing there. Land use, I think it's a big issue. We're going to do some tours recently. We're going to look at the good and the bad. And one of the issues on Friday when we look at the bad, and I'll just throw it out there, the Aurora exit is a really problematic interchange. But I would raise the question, if we're prioritizing scarce public dollars, why would we invest it in an interchange that the community has said we're not going to develop around it? I mean, it seems like we need to make some investments around. If we're going to do that, we need to do it wisely. I could use in my neighborhood, my district, Highway 34 is the same way. We put an incredible amount of money into an interchange there with I-5 and 204. A lot of flat land, but we have chosen not to use the land for development. And at the same time, we look up in the Portland area and we keep building out on the west side, which we can't figure out a way to solve the transportation problem. We're not using the system effectively from a land use perspective, in my opinion. And the last thing, this is probably directed at Sam as a question. I think the seismic and the preservation and the freight mobility issues, have we overlaid that so that my gut level is there are probably some things that we need to do seismically that sort of marry right on top of the things in freight, and we probably ought to be looking for those sweet spots in terms of coming up with our priority transportation list. So that's the question, to say, have we done that?
That is my understanding. That is, along with preservation and maintenance investments, you can do things to bridges and roadways that will enhance seismic resiliency as part of that maintenance.
With that, I will open it to Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about transportation over the last 40 years and spent quite a bit of time as chair of JPAC when I was on the Metro Council. Portland is unique. It's the transportation hub, not just of Oregon, but of the whole Pacific Northwest, because of the Columbia River Gorge, because of the fact that we have a major airport that's not 30 miles out of town. It's right in the middle of the urban area. And there are many advantages, rail lines that intersect, major interstate highways, and so on. But congestion is plugging up that hub, and it's something we need to deal with. There's an interrelationship between bike, pedestrian, transit, and congestion. In my district, there aren't sidewalks in many of our neighborhoods. So what does that mean? It means people either drive their kids to school, maybe only a half a mile, or they get on a school bus and clog up things. If we had sidewalks throughout those urban areas, it'd be opportunities for those kids to walk or ride their bikes safely to school, more exercise, less congestion, tremendous benefits. Transit is something that Portland has done a better job than most cities, but yet we're still not keeping up with things. every time we can get somebody to ride a MAX train or take a bus to work, we free up space on those major highways for freight. And freight has to get to and from the port, through the city, to and from the airport, and so on. And when freight can't move, doesn't move, the economy suffers dramatically. And it's not just a matter of Portland and Oregon, because we happen to be a bi-state urban area. Sometimes we've had a little trouble convincing our friends north of the Columbia River that maybe they ought to hook up to our transit system as well, that they'd be far better off. The congestion for those 100,000 or so people that live in Washington and work in Oregon every day is getting really, really worse and worse and worse. The congestion is horrible on I-5, I-205, and it's starting at 2:30 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon and running until 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and then it starts up again in the morning. So finding a way to continue to expand our transit system is critical, and it's really tough because most states, you know, you put a half a penny on the sales tax and you raise a boatload of money. We can't do that. Or you tap into the highway fund for 10% or 5% for transit. We can't do that. So when I was involved in raising the money for the Green Line and the Orange Line and expanding the transit in the greater Portland area, we did it. We pieced together a little dabble of money from Portland State, a little dabble of money from the city of Portland, a little dabble of money from Multnomah County, a little dabble of money from Clackamas County, and we built those lines. But it's really, really difficult and requires innovation. What people need to understand better is that we are a transportation hub, and for it to work, we've got to figure out ways for more and more people to not use the highways, because that's for freight, but to use transit, use their bike, and so on. So we need it. People need to understand the interrelationship between whether you have sidewalks in your neighborhood and congestion, whether you have a transit system that works, buses and MACs and so on, and congestion, because they're all related. And as we attack the problem, we have to attack it in a multifaceted way. We can't just say, oh, gee, there's massive congestion, so let's put more lanes on the freeways. That won't do it. It doesn't work. Houston found that out a long time ago. I'm sorry, I'm preaching.
So are you done with your sermon?
I'm done preaching.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned the West Side businesses and the congestion in the West Side. Well, I live out there. And I can tell you that I've quit going into Portland. It's just impossible. I only go for Blazer games. So
take the train?
I don't take the train. That takes even longer. But we have Pacific University out in Forest Grove, and they've built campuses now in Hillsboro. The MAX line stops in Hillsboro. And the TV highway, which runs through Hillsboro out through Forest Grove, between those two cities, has become a parking lot. We have a new Walmart in the middle, and those Pacific students, and the combination is deadly. And so I've been fighting for 10 years to extend the MAX line out to Forest Grove, and unsuccessfully. And I'm going to continue that fight. But on the west side, we do have serious problems. They have them on the east side, too. They have them downtown and on the south. And of course, the north going across the bridge. But I don't know the solution as long as we can't agree on a transportation package. And we just have to get there.
Yeah, you know, just a comment on observation that I've made. For those of us like yourself, Senator, who live in the Portland area, you feel the difference every couple of months. It feels more crowded every few months. State came out with a population numbers a month or two ago that said from July to July of the last year, Oregon had 60,000 new residents. If you take the percentage that live in Portland, about 50% of the state, just assume that 30,000 of those new 60,000 residents in 12 months came to the Portland metropolitan area, that's probably low. Probably a bigger percentage of new immigrants are coming into the Portland area. You're putting a small city in 12 months. You're adding a small 30,000 person city inside the metropolitan area with all of the transportation needs that come with 30,000 people, and you can feel it on TV Highway and the East Side on 84 and 26, and I mean it's palpable how different it is for those of us who grew up in Portland and in Oregon, and you know I would say it is you're feeling that same and maybe to lesser degrees in Salem, Albany, Eugene, down the valley, and certainly in some of these growing communities like Bend, and where you know you've got a lot of immigration that are changing the nature of their community and their they don't have the financial tools to change their community, along with the change that's coming from the population.
See, I was convinced that those 30,000 all had moved to Wilsonville.
Well, large percentage probably have, because there's no homes.
That's just where that's where the parking lot starts.
Yep.
Anybody else? Senator.
Yes, actually, I'm trying to read through your recommendations and trying to figure things out. And I don't represent Portland, so please bear with me a little bit. But the question I had is, when we're talking about transit and passenger rail funding, the thing that is glaringly missing is the increase of rates for those people using that. It's right now they're paying 25%. Mm-hmm. I find that just almost insulting, and that's not part of your recommendations. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, we didn't, I think, get into the very specific pieces. Passenger rail is a tough one. There's like with every mode, there's a very passionate group of people who rely on it and believe it can be a big solution. But the costs, as you're pointing out, are very high, and the ability to keep people on it at the prices that it would take to actually pay for the cost of that service are way beyond what people would be willing to pay. So the question is it a viable opportunity for us? Lots of people thought it is a viable opportunity, that if you look at the other subsidies that go into roadways and other modes of transportation, that adding some subsidy in passenger rail, for example, is worth it. And it gets cheaper the more people use it. And if you lose it, you don't have the opportunity to create the kind of asset that you now see in the corridors, like in the East Coast between D.C. and New York, and New York and Boston, where passenger rail is a huge asset and moving lots of people pretty efficiently. But given the numbers of people, given the service that exists, it's kind of a chicken and the egg. If the service is poor, it costs a lot, not a lot of people use it, so the subsidy that has to go into it is very high. It's a tough nut to crack, and I don't think we had any very specific recommendation about passenger rail funding in this.
Well, we want to increase employer payroll taxes, employee payroll taxes, and property tax dedication.
Yeah.
Mainly on
transit. This is really, I think, the focus, and that was part of your question, too. I should have answered that.
No.
On transit, we heard in community after community, from Kaiser to Central Oregon, others, that they can't get employer taxes, payroll taxes passed, so they have no option. They have no ability to raise funds for what the community believes are important assets, like Portland. Portland has an employer tax, just increased it. Business community was actually supportive of the increase because they need the transit to bring their workers to their businesses. They can't get voters. Kaiser, I think, just had a proposed employer tax on their ballot, and it went down again, I think, for maybe multiple times as it's gone down. So that's what you would hear in the communities, is we just need a tool, some sort of financial mechanism that allow us to make those investments. And frankly, I think the business community on an employer tax, for example, as it is in Portland, many of them are beginning to see the difficulties of getting there and attracting good talent to their workplace without the ability to have some transit access.
I don't want you to get me wrong. Yeah. I think mass transit is the wave of the future. Mm-hmm. I spent a week back in D.C. on a transportation symposium, and they built a 5,000-unit complex in the Naval Yards, 300 parking places. So they're relying heavily on mass transit.
Yeah.
But I do believe that the people paying the people that are using it should be paying more than 25%. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's kind of something that was glaring, that was lacking in your recommendations. Another thing is, I probably would disagree a little bit with Chair Beyer, which never occurs, in that Portland, because just exactly what you explained about being a big metropolitan area, you have reverse economies of scale. The problems that you have are capacity problems, and it's one of those, and I am very supportive of the 10 cent a gallon increase that the city of Portland did to try to fix this, but that doesn't mean, I think that excludes us from moving forward and looking at increasing the gas tax and that sort of thing here if we can come to some sort of agreement. But I think I like that idea. Most of your other things, I was trying to read through the chart, and I have to say that...
Just looking at the matrix.
I'm looking at the matrix. And I've kind of been going through that, good, poor, good, very good. And I kind of would like to see somewhere just a summary of, where you think we should be going, because I think it's going to require a whole bunch of different little things to incorporate into a transportation tax. And I think we're going to have to come up with, like Senator Riley said, a major transportation plan statewide. The Port of Portland, I think, really is somewhat over capacity right now. I know that we lost some major employers up there, but I think we need to look at maybe Coos Bay as an alternative for at least agriculture and for Southern Oregon and that sort of thing. But I think this is a good attempt to get started. I just want to say that I know some people believe that the world revolves around Portland, but if you don't represent Portland, we have to have some justification as to why to vote for something other than it benefits Portland. So I would add that to, something that if you're going to make presentations, maybe concentrate a little bit more on what the advantages are to rural Oregon. People in my district might go to Portland 3 or 4 times a year. It isn't something that I think they do every day.
Senator, the one point of disagreement I would have with you is it's not that the world revolves around Portland. The world revolves around getting through Portland.
For some reason. If you're
only those that are trying to sell products.
If you're from Medford, you might not go to Portland once every 5 years.
Yeah.
So
but your freight does.
Well, maybe. But some freight goes in different directions. And that's what I'm saying. If you're talking freight, we really have to start looking at Coos Bay as an alternative.
Well, and that is part of our recommendation, is that we got to do a better job in moving freight and using all the assets that we've got in the state, that every piece of product that gets produced in Oregon shouldn't have to come to Portland or through Portland by truck, for sure. You know, I started out, to tell you the truth, thinking where you were, pretty much that there's a big difference between rural Oregon and urban Oregon, that that what happens in urban Oregon, I've been sensitized over the years to we think differently, we're a different group of people, and we have different interests and different opportunities and challenges in Portland. And it shocked me to go around the state and listen to the commonalities and how somebody in Medford is deeply concerned about how much time it's taking to get their product through and to Portland. And people using the roadways on I-5 and what's happening because of the truck traffic on I-5 from Eugene, from Southern Oregon, what it's doing for their ability to get from Medford to Eugene, or from Ashland to Eugene, or from Bend back over to Eugene or Salem. It's amazing how much commonality. And I think, as I say, on transit, it was a common funding issue. But as you're saying, it's a different transit issue than it is in Portland. It's not the same. Needs.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said from Portland to Eugene. Where I'm at, I live off Highway 22, mm-hmm. the east-west corridors, trying to get to the coast,
yep.
Those are way more important probably, with agriculture being the exception, shipping through the ports or going through Portland. Now, some because of the port shutdown, they have to go clear up yep. to Olympia. But the east-west corridors, so if you include things like, look, we're going to improve the access to the coast, we're going to improve the access to Bend, and not just focus around Portland,
yep.
I think it would get a lot further.
Yes. No, I agree with that. I think you have to, and we talked about bottlenecks and about picking the top priorities. They shouldn't all be in Portland. I mean, this is about the legislative, and one of the reasons we didn't make a very specific recommendation about what are all of the taxes or revenue increases that are needed, is that it is for, I think, you, the policymakers of the state, to balance those out and balance it statewide. That it we titled the report One Oregon because we really do believe it requires investment in every part of the state and a view towards how do you improve the connections across the state, both for people and product.
You know, I'm reminded, it was a couple of years ago, actually, when we were talking about the bridge, God forbid, that we had one of the CEOs of one of the major lumber companies in Southern Oregon made the comment that 8 out of every 10 of the trucks that pull out from one of his mills is going north through Portland, either to the port or Canada or different places. And you have that, and now my grass seed farmers in our area like that are all complaining. They used to be able to get 3 trucks a day going north, and now with the change both in federal driving rules and the congestion, they can do 1. And in fact, most of the time they have to put 2 drivers in it because you can't get in line mm-hmm. when you get up into one of the ports and if your hours are going to run out, so you have to have a second driver in there. And it's largely making their ability to sell their product to the Asian markets uncompetitive.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we have some major issues out there dealing with a lot of this. And a couple of years ago, Christmas tree trees setting on the docks.
Yeah.
More on this, guys?
Just a
Senator Monroe.
A final comment. I like your opening statement, your opening comment that we are one Oregon. I really believe that. I believe that if the port is congested and the highways in Portland are congested and most of the freight comes our way, that really hurts rural Oregon, eastern Oregon, wheat farmers, you name it, because their product has to come through. A lot of people don't realize that most rail traffic, rail freight from the Pacific Northwest goes through Portland. Even from Puget Sound, it comes south and through the gorge. It doesn't go up over the hump. That's too expensive. So, you know, we need to keep that hub open. And that's good for all of Oregon.
Anything else?
Seeing none. Well, Greg, thank you very much for your today and for the spending the last year and a half on this.
Thanks. My pleasure. It was great to work with you.
Your time. And Sam, thank you for the staff work on this. Carmen, did you want to make any comments? You're good? Okay. All right, we will close on that, and we will move on to another transportation project, our standard report from Paul on how are we using our money. Little video to start?
Well, not really. I'm only starting at the beginning, but I'm having trouble here. Let's see if we can get going from there.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to just give you a quick update on a couple of bills. So normally I'm up here talking about projects and things that are going on. Being the spring, we're just getting a lot of our work underway. So I thought I'd spend a little bit of time just talking about a couple of bills that you've passed the last two sessions and just give you an update on how we're doing an implementation of those bills. The two I want to talk about is our speed increase bill. You took it up in 15 and again in 16 to do some fine-tuning to that. So I'll give you an update on how we're doing in implementing that. And the last one was a cable barrier that we've spent some time on.
Yep.
So, as I just said, a couple bills in 15 and 16 that raised the speed limits on some highways in eastern Oregon. The speeds became effective March 1st, and we have all those successfully turned on. We did it in about 2.5 days, a pretty impressive effort by our folks to change all those signs out and get all those implemented. The highways that are affected, here's the map that we showed during the bill. 1,200 miles off the interstate, and then from the Dallas to Ontario on the interstate, and then including I-82, which was the last bill that passed. So kind of three things that we worked on during this. The first was the speed signs. I brought a sign in today just to have you see the magnitude, the size of these signs. A lot of people don't realize how big these signs really are. I'm going to talk at the end here about costs of those, so just give you a kind of an order of magnitude of why things cost what they do.
Is that really the standard size?
That's the standard size, and it's missing the 9-foot post that goes on the end of it just so we get it in the building. So it's, they're a lot larger than you think when you're driving.
Yeah.
When you're driving by.
It is.
The other piece that we talked about in our fiscal statement for the bill was the curve warning signs and all the adjustments that we had to make to the curve warning signs, put up new signs, change the riders, so forth on sign. The last piece, and the most complicated piece I'm going to talk mostly about, is the striping. It's really a piece we missed completely when we were talking about the bill. We had to go through and change or evaluate at least all the striping on the 1,200 miles of non-interstate roads. And I'll talk about why we did that in a minute. So the signs, we needed to add the word limit to them. We needed to add the truck sign on the non-interstate. So before, when you're off the interstate, it was just speed 55. There wasn't a distinction between trucks and cars. Now on those routes, we have a distinction. So we had to add those. Both those caused the signs to be bigger, more wind load, a bigger post, higher signs, so forth.
So, Paul, the cost of all that. I want to make sure that I'm correct from the meetings we had during the session. If the sign isn't an assigned speed limit, it falls under the basic rule?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
So those signs, if they don't have a limit on it, are just suggestions?
Well, they fall under the basic rule. So I wouldn't use maybe the word suggestion, but they fall under the basic rule, which we can get into. One of the big changes you did in the bill was to establish a limit. So now it's like a school zone, mm-hmm. Or other limits that we have in the state. These routes now have limits on them rather than subject to the basic rule. And so we need to denote that in the sign and add the word limit to the speed to denote the difference for the drivers. So anyway, both those changes caused us to have larger signs. Again, those are things we kind of predicted, we knew about, we're in a fiscal, weren't surprised to us. The surprise came as we started dealing with this was the striping. We had to, again, reevaluate 1,200 miles of non-interstate highway. We had to determine where those speeds, those striping changes need to be for pass and no pass, and get those implemented, not by March 1st, which was really the troubling part. We had to do it by October 1st because of the weather. Signs you can put up in bad weather, striping needed to be done in about 10 weeks after the governor signed it. We had to go out and reevaluate 1,200 miles of road, get those done, get the plans to our striping crews, and they had to go out and make those changes. The changes are, so when you're driving 55 miles an hour, you need about 900 feet of sight distance to make a determination to pass or not to pass. As you go up to 65 and 70 miles an hour, those distances change because you're going faster. We have to generate a set of plans that are stamped by an engineer. These are traffic control devices that if there's a crash, there's a lawsuit, so forth, we've got to have documentation on why we set the actual striping where we did. Extremely challenging, and to think about how we do that, I'm going to show you a video here in a minute about how we figured this out, but our normal way of doing this is two guys in a stick and a wheel walking down the highway saying, can you see me now? And doing that for 1,200 miles, generating a set of plans stamped by an engineer to a striping crew in 10 weeks was virtually kind of impossible to think about. And if we hadn't figured this out, I'd be sitting here telling you why we hadn't got all the speed signs up or implemented yet, because we hadn't figured this out. So here's just a short video on how we solved this 10-week problem.
Using LIDAR. Your favorite, they use LIDAR.
House Bill 3402, legislature passed this in July of last year. What it did was to raise the speeds on 1,200 miles of rural highway and 300 miles of interstate in eastern Oregon. It took most of that 1,200 miles of rural highway and took it from 55 miles an hour to 65 miles an hour for cars and to 60 miles an hour for trucks. The interstate from the Dalles to Ontario goes from 65 to 70 for passenger vehicles and to 60 miles an hour for trucks. There were a lot of implications. You raise the speed limit, what else is affected? Signs, transition areas where you might be coming to a new speed limit in a city, and striping. In particular, pass and no pass zones. How do we make sure that those are safe at the new higher speeds all across the system? And the traditional way of doing that was for somebody to go stand in the middle of the road and another person go down the distance that that particular speed said you should be that far away if you're going to start a passing maneuver. And they would talk back and forth and say, well, can you see me now? And we thought that for 1,200 miles of rural two-lane highways, that was a daunting task. Couldn't there be another way, a safer way, and a more efficient way of trying to evaluate where we needed to be? And we spent a little bit of time trying to figure out if any other state had gone through this in such a large change on a two-lane rural highway. And what we got back was that most of the upper speed limits that had happened were on larger facilities like interstates. And this kind of striping issue hadn't had to be considered over the course of hundreds of miles of highway. So we thought about a lot of things, and one of the things that came up was that the Department of Transportation had a vehicle that allowed us to collect information about our highway in a pretty amazing way.
Our mobile mapper is mounted on top of a vehicle, and it contains seven cameras that take a panoramic image. It also has a laser scanner that collects about a million points per second, and the images are collected at about every 25 feet.
We determined that the data set that we have, which is essentially LIDAR that we collected across all the state highway systems with our mobile mapping device, was something we could use to determine the sight distance requirements for the no passing zones. LIDAR is light detection and ranging, and it is a tool that is used to calculate or to capture 3D positions of anything you want. And so it is essentially a system that puts out a laser pulse that goes off in a particular direction, hits something like a tree, comes back, and we can calculate the distance. Then based on calculating the angles and distance, we can get a 3D point in space, and then we do that millions of times a second, and we end up with what you might think of as a hologram, one way to think of it, or as a 3D photograph. A photograph that you can actually step into, look around, up, down, left, right, measure, and do whatever you want. It's very accurate, within a quarter of an inch or so. We sat down and discussed whether it was possible. We discussed who would do what, and we came up with this collaborative effort. Geomatronics, taking the existing data that we had and mining it for the information that was needed so that the roadway team could then calculate the site distances, who would then pass it on to the traffic team, who would develop a set of plans so that they would then pass that on to the striping crew who would stripe the roads.
After Geomatronics gets the data, we take it and process it, and then we trace the features of the roadway and create a map, and then that is used to create a model of the roadway.
What roadway's part was, after we collected the data from the Geomatronics unit, we created a three-dimensional model of the roadway, representative of the roadway location, and then included a vertical element at the edge of the pavement that then we used our design software package to analyze the site distances, where the site distance was acceptable or not acceptable, and then gave that off to traffic.
It required a lot of collaboration across many different disciplines, across a lot of different offices and geographic locations. We had regions and districts across regions 4 and 5, and the respective striping crews and traffic crews out there as well. Everybody had their own little piece of the pie, and every piece was extremely critical, but the end goal was to get a plan to the striping crew as quickly as possible in a way that they could easily pick up and lay out and install before the end of the season.
So out of all of that, we were able to get all of the striping in place well in advance of the close of the weather season, and signs will all be going up within the first week of when the new speed limits are operational, which is the week of March 1st.
LiDAR is an amazing technology. It enables the creation of a virtual world which can be used for a multitude of things, and your imagination is really the only limiting factor. We can use it to extract all sorts of data and information from it. We can use it to overlay things on it, and in essence, we're creating the world at your fingertips. This effort actually showed the value of collecting LiDAR data across the entire state highway system, and without it, we would have struggled to accomplish this task.
So, Paul, were they able, once they engineered where the stripe should be, did you convert that to a GPS designation that the truck could automatically run off of, the striping truck?
Mr. Chairman, we're not quite there yet, but that's once we get into the future, that is certainly possible. This technology that they're describing is what we use in our design and thus into construction. And in those examples, the data is straight from our designer software right into the construction equipment, and in many cases not using any surveying at all, and the equipment's able to go out there in a very efficient manner, do the construction work. And eventually we'll get to that point with the striping in our equipment, but we're not quite there with the investment we have yet. There we go. So just back to the cost, which is very kind of cool. The point of the signs, the curve sign, the speed signs, pretty much matched our original fiscal that we had on it. The surprise was the striping cost, and you can see that about doubled the overall estimate it was to make these changes. If we hadn't done the technology piece, that striping component would have been 2 or 3 times that amount. If we were, like I said, likely would be still out there trying to make those changes to the striping so we could implement the speeds. But as I said, to open with, we made those changes by March 3rd. The implementation date was March 1st. By March 3rd, all those highways were increased in speed. The next one I want to talk about was...
Before you leave that, what's the approximate cost of putting the signs up?
Each of those signs are around $750 a piece for a sign and a post and labor to put it up.
Does that include labor costs of putting it up?
Yes.
$750 a sign.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I double check, make sure I got that number right. I think I'm close with that.
They're a lot bigger than I thought they were.
So Senate Bill 921 gave direction to the department to install cable barrier on medians where they were 100 feet or less, or a high priority medians. In the bill, we had until 2021 to complete the task. In the 2015 session, legislature also passed $2.5 million to put cable barrier up on I-5. We had several projects already in our program, so combined with that money, we were able to complete I-5. In October of 15, the Oregon Transportation Commission took savings on other projects and moved about $5 million to complete 205 in the first portion of I-84 in the program. And then in the FAST Act, which you're going to hear about in the next agenda item, in the FAST Act, there was additional money programmed for the balance of I-84. So the good news is we now have funding programmed for the completion of Senate Bill 921 and the closure of those mediums that are 100 feet or less throughout the interstate system.
So I've noticed between Salem and Eugene, there have been a number, unfortunately, of cars that have chosen to use that barrier.
Yeah.
What have you found in terms of reduced fatalities or injuries, and what's the cost of restringing that once it's been you ran into?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't have that data with me, but I'll tell you just anecdotally, our folks are seeing the same things you are. They're surprised by how often those are hit. I mean, obviously we're called out anytime there's a crash or major damage, but now that we have those barriers up, they're out there quite often having to do repairs to those. We have an on-call contract with the installer or a provider of those systems, and they go out there and do the repairs to the cable barrier once it's hit. But it's hit I think a lot more than any of us thought it would be hit, and just the amount of vehicles and exposure that was of going through the median was surprising, I think, to a lot of us.
It appears that it's really stopped what would have been rollovers in the past.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's stopped mostly just the traffic going across and really creating those really dangerous, deadly head-on collisions at freeway speeds has been the
Can those benefit. Cables generally just be pulled back taut again with new posts put in?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, exactly. The posts are designed to shear off, and the cables come taut, so you've got to go back and retension the cables. There's usually slots for new posts to go back in at where they broke off at, and put those back up. Right.
Cool. Works.
Good. So that's all I had on those two bills.
The project to the coast, are we on schedule to get that fixed this year?
Yes, Pioneer Mountain Eddyville. We opened bids on the last portion of that about a month ago. The contractor, K&E Excavation here in Salem, won the bid. They're actually out there already working 12-hour shifts starting last week. Looking at their schedule showing somewhere around the first week in October opening up that new alignment. So they have work that will carry over into next season. I think, as I described before, where we'll be doing work on the existing highway and the tie-in from the new alignment to the existing highway, but the new route will be open to traffic this fall.
So when will the blasting be done?
The blasting will have to go back and look at their schedule. I think they have some blasting that carries over into next spring. But the majority of it will be this year. The good news is they looked at their schedule. Traffic-wise, we'll have not any significant delays through the first couple months of the summer. The blasting piece through about the month of August is where we'll see the delays. But they'll give a week advance notice to people that
They're doing those at nighttime.
Right? As much work as possible will be doing at night. Correct.
Cool. Any questions, Paul, Senator?
You probably heard me say that I just got back from a symposium, and I spent some time with the automobile manufacturers, and indigenous cars are supposedly going to come online in 2020. Are we starting to prepare for that? I don't know exactly what all it's going to require to try to, I mean, there's going to be some conversion costs somewhere, and I just kind of wonder if your department has started looking into that, and the next 20 years, things are going to change radically, and I think we need to start really concentrating on that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerard, yes. So we've started to look into this. In fact, tomorrow in House Transportation, there's going to be a presentation that we're going to be part of that talks about what's coming and what we're doing as a department to prepare for that. There's a myriad of issues that affect many aspects of what we do in the department. We've formed a group that represents from DMV all the way on through our design and planning staff in the department to begin to look at those. We've hired a position in the department that is dealing with electrical vehicles as well as automated vehicles, and really be in touch with the national conversation to make sure that we hear the latest and are engaged in the latest changes as things change rapidly from every few months. Things are evolving, and we need to be on our toes and be ready for those changes.
What kind of ability do we have to change stoplights, for example? I mean, you know, the car is going to be talking to the stoplight mm-hmm. down the road, and so what ability do we have to change, say, you just change an electrical circuit or something so that we have that? I'm just trying to, or a circuit board, mm-hmm. so we have the ability to do that. I'm just,
yeah.
You hate to put in, I mean, those things aren't cheap, and you hate to put them in, and then they're outdated 5 years down the road, or you hate to design a road that's not going to be indigenous compatible, and, you know, the lane widths, everything is going to be on the table here within 20 years, and so I find it kind of scary a little bit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerard, yes, it's kind of scary, but also kind of exciting. And what we're able to do, the current controllers that we have, just as I described it, our striping equipment, a lot of it's not compatible with a lot of the expectations we're going to see. But the new stuff that we're putting in is for what we know in the future. But again, this stuff changes very, very rapidly, and what even the stuff we're putting in today, 10 years from now, may be obsolete, and there may be enough benefit to make further changes. But we're trying, again, being part of that national conversation. We have people on our staff that are seen as national experts in some of these areas, and so we're feeling like we're not maybe on the very cutting edge of this, but we're right behind some of the leaders in the country on many of these aspects, and the changes that we're making to traffic signals or variable speed limits or those things, we're keeping in tune with those changes and putting the things in practice that meet those kind of best practices nationwide.
I suspect that striping is going to become even more important.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, that's one aspect of what vehicles depend on is striping, and having a good quality stripe out there will be important.
Yeah, I don't know what you do in the mountains when it's all covered with snow, but
yeah.
Anything else? Thank you very much. Next up, we have a review of the FAST Act. So we've got new federal money. We won't worry about where it's coming from. That doesn't make any sense. But
it doesn't.
That makes no sense at all. But they got the money. They got the money.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Trevor Sleeman. I'm the Federal Affairs Advisor and Tribal Liaison at ODOT. And I'll give you a brief overview of the FAST Act today, and then I'll turn it over to Paul to talk a little bit more about. It's been passed about 6 months ago, so now we're kind of getting into the implementation phase. So there's some news to share there as well. But stepping back to December of last year, Congress passed the FAST Act. This is the if you're familiar with the acronyms from the past, like SafetyLoo, MAP21, T21, this is the multi-year federal authorization of surface transportation policy and funding. And actually, it's the first such bill that Congress has passed in over a decade, the first long-term authorization they passed in over a decade. There was something like 36 or 38 short-term extensions. I lost count, frankly. So the fact that the bill passed and has locked in that policy and funding through 2020, a five-year period, is pretty amazing when you consider that a year ago we didn't know how much federal money we would have 5 days from now, let alone 5 years from now. So an important sea change, to be sure. So just a quick look at the funding. Kind of the theme for the day will be modest funding growth. So the FAST Act did include some year-over-year growth. That's the first year there in 2016, that's about a 5% bump, and then 2% or so a year thereafter. So when you compare that to the last 4 years, that's certainly a welcome change after being flat funded for a number of years. But you can see...
How does that compare to your cost of construction, that index?
Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. Mr. Chairman, yeah, the inflation, construction, I'm trying to remember what the number is, but it's higher than general inflation, typically closer that. Around the 5% range. And so if you look at these numbers, it's a lot of it's going to be offset.
Can I answer?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think you're right, but with the decrease in oil, the cost of asphalt should drop pretty dramatically. So this last year might change that a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, too. Yes, we are seeing an impact from those changes in the commodity for asphalt. The dynamics in place from steel to concrete to asphalt and diesel prices all vary over time. And I guess looking over a longer view than a particular construction season, we're seeing the construction inflation factor being pretty consistent over a long term of about, you know, in that 5%-ish range.
5%?
Yeah.
Annual?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I can get you some exact numbers. I'm trying to remember, but it bounces between 3.5 and 7.5, and so I'm at 5%, I think, is a pretty typical number.
It's important.
So anyway, if you kind of take things into context, you can see that, you know, of course, while the funding increases are appreciated, we don't actually get back to our 2011 funding levels until somewhere around that 17-18 time period. So it's not as if this significantly upends things in any way. And the one kind of final funding point I would make is that, you heard a little bit earlier about the struggles that the state highway fund has with gas tax revenues going down, and the same thing is happening at the federal level, where the gas tax, I think, hasn't been raised since 1993. So there are more revenues going out of the fund than coming in, and that's been a problem for a number of years, and Congress has transferred in general fund revenues several times to keep the fund solvent, including with the FAST Act. So they didn't actually do anything in the bill to address that problem. So they punted it 5 years out in the future, and if anything, it'll be worse 5 years from now when the bill expires. So we'll kind of be back at that same point when we get through the bill. So that look forward to that challenge. And it's the point, this isn't the easiest slide to read, but the point is that funding to all governments, state and local governments, increases under the FAST Act. However, not all local governments are created equal in the eyes of Congress when it comes to surface transportation funding. You see the top square on the stack there, a rectangle on the stack there. That's funding to TMAs. Those are transportation management areas, which are large MPOs, so metropolitan planning organizations over 200,000 in total population. So we have three of those in Oregon: Portland Metro, Salem-Keizer, and Central Lane. So funding to those large MPOs will not only grow because of that overall growth I showed you in the last slide, but they'll also be getting a larger slice of the pie. So Congress changed the distribution of funds a little bit to give a more favorable distribution of funds.
So that's just pass-through money that's delegated, right?
It's money that's made available through the Surface Transportation Program to those three.
ODOT has no control over that money.
That's the funding that, Mr. Chair, that's the funding that... The large MPOs program through their metropolitan transportation improvement plans.
go ahead.
Yeah, I have the acronym TAP. Could you explain what that is?
That's the Transportation Alternatives Program. So that's a set aside, Mr. Chair, Senator Girod, a set aside within the Surface Transportation Block Grant Program for funding non-highway.
Bicycles and that. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that the transit funding piece too?
Transit's not represented here. Since that comes from a separate account in the trust fund, it's not represented here.
Sure.
Senator Monroe?
So the feds did this without raising the federal gas tax or raising additional highway revenue, right? So it's being funded out of the general fund?
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, that could be a very long separate conversation, but there are a number of mechanisms they used. I'll say creative accounting mechanisms to capture general fund revenues. They also rated a really large surplus account at the Federal Reserve Bank. A number of different measures they went to.
It's called congressional magic.
I've been told it's like the pea game, and you don't know where the pea is under the shells, and they kind of move things around. But the net result is that in order to increase some funding for a federal highway system, they're actually increasing overall the national debt, which is already a problem. I just think it was really irresponsible what they did. The only thing that would have been more irresponsible would have been to do nothing at all.
Yeah. Well said. Anyway.
So funding within those large areas grows in particular. And in fact, if you look back to 2012, which was the last year before the prior authorization, MAP 21, passed, and then you look ahead through 2020, which is the last year of the FAST Act, funding in those large MPOs will have grown by 38%, while funding to the state overall has grown by only 14%.
So, can you talk about just the categories and what the restrictions are and how much
certainly
control or guidance ODOT has over those?
So the next two down, the STP to cities and counties, that's the Surface Transportation Program and the Local Bridge Program, that's funding that comes to ODOT that we share by agreement, agreements that we negotiate with AOC and LOC to share with local governments. Not all states do that. That's not something we're required to do, but that's how those revenues get passed through, and that goes through to the local governments outside those large MPOs.
So does that mean that the money has to be spent on local street systems and not on the interstate or state highways?
Yes, Chair Beyer, for funding in those that flows through local governments by those agreements, yes.
So the only discussion point for ODOT for those two middle ones is what the sharing formula is among cities and counties?
Chair Beyer, I believe so.
The local bridge, there's actually a committee made up of ODOT staff as well as local governments that make up decisions on how to spend that local bridge.
So that's a need-based rather than a formulaic?
Formula, and then the STP, there's a formula that goes out to the cities.
That's
the
formula.
Counties, right?
Okay.
And then the other program categories are shared through with local governments as well, and all those programs will get that same modest funding increase I showed in the last chart.
So do we? I guess I've never really focused on this. So how do we get money to maintain the state highways and freeways from the feds? Do we?
Mr. Chair, this just represents the component that's going to local governments. We're going to talk to you about the rest of the bill and so forth. This is just the component within the FAST Act that goes to local governments. We'll talk about the piece that.
So this is the local side.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Got it.
Just to prove the general point.
If I'd read the title on the slide, it would figure that out.
Right.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah. just to show the point that funding to everybody under the FAST Act grows. So one of the from ODOT's perspective anyway, one of the biggest areas of reform in the bill relates to freight transportation and policy. The bill actually That's created right. two new freight-related programs after, I think, years of advocacy by stakeholders in the freight community to set aside a dedicated program for freight. So one of which, the National Highway Freight Program, which we call the Formula Freight Program, it's a new program that ODOT will receive highway trust fund revenues by formula in each year of the bill. It works out to be about $14.5 million on average each year to program for freight projects. It's primarily reserved to a set of high-volume, high-capacity roads, mostly the interstate system in Oregon. There are some connectors on there as well, and we'll have an opportunity later on to add some mileage around the margins. But for the most part, this program is geared toward funding freight projects on the interstate system. And though it's reserved to that restricted network of roads, there's pretty broad project eligibility for the sorts of things we can do, bridge and pavement work, intelligent transportation system type work, truck parking projects, those sorts of things are all eligible. And in addition, not only can construction projects be funded, but development type projects, development work can be funded too. And you'll see some of that a little bit later on too. The bill also created several new grant programs, competitive grant programs. These are just a few of them. The Fastlane grant program is the second component I mentioned related to freight. It's a competitive grant program. If you're familiar with the Tiger grant program, it's similar to size and competitiveness with Tiger. It's designed for the most part to fund very large freight-related projects. So by very large, they mean over $100 million in total cost in Oregon. There are some set-asides within the program for smaller projects, for rural projects, for multimodal projects, but the main, the bulk of the program is geared at funding those very large $100 million plus projects.
That's national competitive grants?
That's correct, Chair Beyer. It is $800 million available nationwide this year in 2016. That steps up by $50 million. Each year, so by the end of the FAST Act, there will be $1 billion available nationwide. So there will be four more grant rounds in each of the next 4 years through this program. It does have it's a pretty prescriptive program. It does have very significant match requirements. The OTC did decide to pursue funding for three projects under that program. Which you may have seen in separate committees, but for 2016, the OTC decided to pursue funding for a $150 million expansion and retrofit of the I-205 Abernathy Bridge. In the rural and small project category, a $20 million total project with about a $5 million fast lane component to construct a truck climbing lane on I-84 in eastern Oregon and Ladd Canyon. And then in the small and urban category, about a $48 million total project with a $20 million fast lane contribution to expand I-5 to three lanes in each direction in South Salem between the Kubler Interchange and Delaney Road. A couple of the other interesting grant programs. One is set up to fund kind of a research and not so much research and development as more of an applied program for testing surface transportation funding alternatives. What they've dubbed it, and it's a program that actually fits pretty well with what we've done through the Origo program, the Road User Charge program. We have submitted a grant application through that program. There's $15 million available this year, and then $20 million each year thereafter. So there's there will be more rounds of grant funding available through that program. The Congestion Management and Technology Deployment Program gets at some of the things. Actually, I think Senator Girard, you were mentioning in the prior presentation about vehicle to vehicle infrastructure, vehicle to infrastructure. Things like advanced signal timing and those sorts of technologies. We're working on putting together an application through that program as well. It's not due here for another couple of weeks, so it's still being refined. But all of these programs represent opportunities for us to go out and bring more federal revenues to Oregon, and we've been very aggressive about that and plan to continue to do so in the future.
Mr. Chair. And yesterday, your transportation sub of the e-board, which I sit on, approved those three grant applications, the Abernathy Bridge, the I-84, and the Kubler Road, and that'll be voted on tomorrow by the full emergency board. And that means that we go ahead with the application. Doesn't mean it guarantees that we get the money.
Just to kind of piggyback on what you were saying, if you look at the congestion management slide you have there, the indigenous cars, that will go directly to them, and so they'll take alternative routes. So, again, we just have to start thinking outside the box as to what's coming. And like you said, it's fun, but it's scary at the same time.
And Chair Byer, Senator Girard, that program, it has pretty robust funding. So, again, each year of the FAST Act, there will be a grant round, and there's $60 million available nationally. So I would hope that at some point in the 5 years, we stand a chance to bring some of that revenue back.
205, you can make it pay really quick. Yeah, some of the slowdown areas and whatever, if you could get around those by an alternative route, that would really be helpful.
So now we just have signs that advise people what might be the quicker way. In the future, they might tell the car to go a different way.
The car will just go that way. You'll tell people what to do.
So that's it for the kind of the broad policy overview, and I'll turn it over to Paul to talk about where we are in terms of implementing it and how the FAST Act impacts ODOT programs.
So, Chair Byer, I think this gets at your question. So what about the state's portion of this? And I'm going to talk in terms of our STIP or our capital program. Our capital program, the STIP, has two different time periods. The 15-18 STIP has been adopted by our commission. We're off delivering projects. This adds new money to that. And so our commission's had to go back and add projects to our existing STIP, and I'll talk about that here in just a second. And then we're also in the process of updating our STIP for the 18-21 time period, and so it alters our selection processes, especially with the freight component that we just heard about, adds new money, and then adds some new direction from a freight standpoint that we're making adjustments to our selection process. So this is the list of projects that our commission added to the 15-18 STIP, so our existing STIP. The numbers there in the left column are our regions. Region 1 is Portland area. Region 2 is Northwest. 3, Southern Oregon, Central Oregon, and then Eastern Oregon. So you can see we've got a variety of projects there. The bolded projects are those freight projects, so they meet the requirements in the existing bill based on what we have approved as freight routes. The unbolded projects are more of the fixed variety, but you'll see some seismic work in there as our commission begins to look at some of the stuff you heard about from the Vision Committee and begin to look at improvements on 97. And then the two cable barrier projects that I talked about in the previous presentation, there you see funding for those that complete the median crossovers.
So where it says development, that's engineering language for...
Obviously 205, Stafford, Oregon City, Rose Quarter, and then more on I-5, those projects that were developed, those are large projects, $300, $400, $500 million project. We just got to get started on those. But those are ones, as you just listed off, Trevor listed off the projects we applied for, we're kind of strategically lining those up so whether it's this round, next round, or one of these five rounds, we can apply for funding for those. We just need to start getting going and knowing what we're applying for, how much it's going to cost, and to kind of be ready for those rounds. But those three projects that the e-board subcommittee approved yesterday are on this list to help provide us match for those funds and be competitive in a very competitive process nationally to bring additional funding home for those projects.
So these projects, this is the STIP is a bottoms-up planning process. This is the top recommendations per region, I assume, that are coming from your area acts.
Mr. Chair, this is a little bit off because, again, this STIP has been through that bottoms-up process, but now we've got an infusion of federal funds that we've got to start getting obligated this year, next year, and the following year. So we didn't have time to go through that whole process all over again for 15-18. And the requirements in the bill around freight really limited the amount of places we could put those freight projects. So we came as a staff, as recommendation to the commission. We did do a volley out to ACTS and so forth to get some reaction to those. I took the freight projects, for example, to our freight advisory committee, got their input. But it was an abbreviated process, but we did touch bases with those.
I think where I was going on that was these projects don't pop up out of the blue at over at ODOT's offices. These are mainly things that have come up from the local level.
In the Portland metro area, two of the projects you hear almost every time, 205 Rose Quarter, are two obvious priorities. Obviously, they have other priorities that they would like to see on the list, but, you know, given, you know, the dollar amounts. The other thing you'll see on here is kind of a mixture of those development dollars to position us for grants, but also an auxiliary lane there. The very first project will be a completion of an additional lane from 217 all the way south to 205. So the work we have going on now with this work will add an additional lane that will take you now all the way from 217 to get off at 205. Will be the completion of that. So some strategic stuff that we can start dealing with congestion now in some of those key corridors. So the commission wanted to do a balance of things we had on the ground now, but also position us for some of these grants in the future.
When you say from 217 to 205, does that include the merge at the southern end of 205?
Yeah, so this is southbound. So yes. You're southbound from 217. We have work underway.
Is that merge between I-5 and 205 is a mess?
Yeah, so this will match into the work we've done from 217 south to, I think, Lower Boones Ferry, and it takes from Lower Boones Ferry down to 205 is what this project does.
That's a tough spot.
Yeah, so it'll help that spot, but it's certainly not going to
solve
everything.
Yeah. I'm not sure that you can solve everything. Yeah.
So that's just to kind of give you an idea of the impact that when Trevor was talking about the federal dollars, what this looks like in ODOT's program. There is additional. This is on the enhanced side. So there's additional money also from the FAST Act that goes into our pavements and bridges that's not shown here, but you'll see. An increase in the amount of bridges and pavements and culverts that we're able to get to as well. The commission actually added those to the STIP back in October as we were anticipating this bill being passed and the need to get these funds obligated. They added those projects back in,
So that's 12 projects on top of what you already got. Where are we in terms of capacity of ODOT to manage all these things at one time?
Just our ability to deliver these. Our staff right now is pretty maxed out in that we went through reductions because of where we were previously, not knowing what was going to happen on the federal side, seeing revenues decline because people are driving less and so forth. That has shifted, you know, the last 18 months to 2 years, and now with this additional federal dollars, our staff is maxed out. We're utilizing consultants to help us with that, but if we're going to be talking about a funding package on top of this federal revenue, we're going to do something different in our delivery mechanism if we're going to be able to deliver projects.
Hopefully we'll get some advice back from the consultants on the study on that.
Yeah. So looking ahead to 18-21, so we're midstream in the process of selecting those, that bottom-up process, Mr. Chair, that you talked about. Here are the general categories that the commission put that additional revenue in. So in our fix-it program, which is dealing with bridges and pavements and culverts, there's a seismic component in there and an ADA component in the fix-it side. The enhanced, we have a non-highway enhanced process already underway with our ACTS. They're selecting projects. They're, you know, narrowing those down. We just added some additional money, so rather than the cut line going, you know, at this project, it's just going to, you know, move down the list a little further around the state. The freight component, we still have to update our freight plans and our bottleneck report before we get into selecting projects in the freight component. The strategic investment is really a piece that the commission wanted to hold back as we go through further rounds of grant application and we need match for those. It's something they wanted to kind of hold back and apply in these various rounds of grants that we were just talking about, give us the leverage or the match requirements to be competitive in those. So that's something they've held back. If we're not successful in any of those grants, that money is still available. It'll fold back into the enhanced side of our program. So to wrap it up, this kind of gives you the bigger picture of our program, the mountain chart, so as we call it. You've seen me talk about this before, looking back at 2000. You'll see what the FAST Act does there with kind of that triangle, almost pyramid-shaped slice wedge in there of additional funding. The big piece is not the big news in the FAST Act, again, is not the amount of revenue. It's the stability, and we're able to now plan for the next 5 years rather than for the next 5 months about what our program is going to look like, and be more thoughtful about those, do a better job looking to leverage projects, and just plan our work for consultants and contractors and others.
Great.
That's our presentation.
Paul, not now, but I wonder at some point if you could kind of do our point is to, as we get into the broader transportation discussions, the overlay where we're sort of getting a double bang, we're starting to address not only the preservation and maintenance and that, but also the seismic issues.
Yes.
Yeah. Where those sweet spots are.
Mr. Chairman, I noted that in your comments under the vision. We've been doing a lot of work around how they can dovetail together, and we'll be able to talk to you about
sort
that.
Sort of as we prioritize, if we can get both of those, that might be a good thing to do. All right. Senator Girard.
Oh, thank you. And maybe I should say this to the next presenter. But the question I have is, for every penny that we raise together, this is not to do with what you're here for, but for every cent that we raise in the gas tax, do you have any idea how much revenue that generates?
So maybe we'll take a brief recess.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, you know, the rule of thumb that I use, and I'm sure some of our folks back at or have a more exact number than this, but just a general rule of thumb I use is $25 million a penny.
$25 million?
Yeah, it's I think it's 26.5 or something. But if you just want to use a rule of thumb that I use, I just use $25 million a penny.
That works. It's easy for us that are old.
Yeah,
thank you. And the second thing, and this would be extremely controversial, but if we're going to look at packages on the East Coast. P3 agreements, I don't know if I'm sure you're familiar with those. Have you looked into how the state could benefit from such an agreement? I'm thinking of 205, putting another lane on 205. As in Delaware, it tells you how much it costs you to go into that lane, then they pay for it. So they're kind of unique, and they're kind of, like I said, it'd be controversial, but if we're trying to get to $1 trillion, the gas tax is not going to get us there.
Right.
So we have to start looking at some other things.
And that's part of what you could look at is part of the public-private partnership. A lot of those have been done that way.
Mr. Chair, those are being used around the country, and we're familiar with those, and we've looked at various projects and their applicability to using that P3 arrangement, and there's pluses and minuses of doing it. You got to find the right fit for the right project and the right financing to make all of that make sense.
I think one thing that's imperative for that to work is there has to be an alternative. You know, that you don't have to pay it, but for a buck or something, you can go into a lane that's going to get you there 10 minutes faster. And that would pay for the capacity increase. And some of these really congestion areas that Portland wants to deal with, and it's something that I think we need to have on the table.
I mean, that's probably the most likely place you could do that would be 205.
Yeah, I think 205 is it.
Would be a likely place. It reminds me a lot of there's a I-5 going south out of Los Angeles towards San Diego has that, and they actually just took the median and put it in there.
Right.
Yeah.
And you have to have an automated tolling transponder.
Right.
Click.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much. Very informative. We're waiting on our last speaker, so let's take a 5-minute recess. On sort of like Kmart. We're back in session. I'll see you in a minute. Welcome.
Thank you.
You made it down.
I did.
You're on.
Perfect. Well, Senator Beyer, thank you very much for inviting me here. Senator Girard, good to see you again a week after visiting in Washington, D.C. And thank you for the rest of the committee for taking time. My name is Joe McAndrew. I serve as the Policy Director of Transportation for America, a national coalition of local elected officials, chambers of commerce, metropolitan planning organizations working throughout the country to ultimately help raise the transportation revenue that's necessary, answer the tricky questions, and make sure that the policy's in place to make sure that we're spending our limited, scarce resources as best as we can. We do this work at the federal, state, and local level. What you have there is a new report that's coming out from us on the federal FAST Act, the bill that passed in December. We'll be presenting on it tomorrow here at the state capitol. So, but today I'm here to talk about state funding packages and policies to make sure you're getting the best bang for the buck. We do that through what we call the State Transportation Advocacy Research and Training Network, the START Network. We launched it in November of 2014 after the election. In December, we had 30 states represented. And at the end of the day, what we're bringing together are state legislators, their staff. Patrick was present, and local elected officials and advocates really trying to tell the story of how to successfully raise transportation funding packages and reform the program to achieve the outcomes that we set out to achieve. We will be holding a conference again in November of this year, but we've been doing this service working with state legislators throughout the country. But before I get into the specifics of what's happening throughout the country, I just want to highlight three important facts that we need to understand. And I don't want to put too much pressure on you, but I think it's really important for you to understand that you guys are the ones that hold the keys in terms of how the state transportation program is ultimately going to go ahead and develop and move forward. And that's really because the federal program receives a lot of attention, but the federal program is really a block grant down to your state and to your state DOT in terms of how those funds are going to be spent. And that was really established with the MAP 21 law that passed in 2012 and has been continued by the FAST Act. So it's important that the state leadership direct or create the policy that are going to achieve the outcomes you want. And that's really important because at the end of the day, you guys are going to be asked to be put in a position, I believe, next year to raise some revenue potentially here. But even if you were to raise the gas tax 5, 10, 15, 20 cents, it's not going to be enough to really solve all of the needs for everybody in the state. So you need to develop the policy that's going to go ahead and ensure that you're getting the return that your constituents are seeking for from your investments. So states throughout the country have really kind of taken the lead for you guys. 23 states have raised transportation funding since 2012. Last year, the states around you, Washington, Idaho, took steps to do it, but a lot of very conservative states did as well. South Dakota, Kentucky, North Carolina, Georgia all took steps last year to raise funding. This year has been a little bit slow. I think it's largely due to heading into a general election this fall, but we don't expect it to slow next year. Important note for you guys, 98% of those folks that voted for a package before the 2014 election, regardless of party, were returned or won their next primary. As long as you guys can take the vote and explain to the electorate what they're getting in return for that investment, it's been proven that time and time again that you're going to ultimately win your next election. So it's not that third rail that a lot of people are fearful of. But raising revenue, I think, is not the hard thing. We know how to do it. There's many different ways to do it, but creating the policy to ensure that you're directing those dollars in an appropriate way is kind of the new front, and some states are leading in that regard. But I think, you know, why it's important that we focus on and work with you guys is that Congress isn't going to come and save the day. Some folks are optimistic that the new president will come in with a new Recovery Act, but I'm skeptical of that. And we don't expect anything to come from them until 2020 when the FAST Act expires. We released a report in January of this year that really started to focus in on the policies that we think that are important for folks at the state level to consider alongside transportation funding packages. And it really focuses in on a few different key themes, and I'll highlight a couple of these with some stories here. But one is increasing accountability and transparency to build taxpayer confidence. The second one is making states economically competitive, empowering locals to do the same. Investing in innovation and rewarding the smartest transportation projects. Competition is one way to do that. You guys have one here with Connect Oregon.
using TDM to manage your facilities. Transportation demand management is a key concept as well. Maximizing savings through better project development. I'm going to highlight some projects there, and then improving safety through better street design. So I'm going to highlight number one. I think that this is important. Too often, transportation decisions are really kind of made in a black box in many states, and we kind of hold our decisions close to the vest, and then all of a sudden decisions are made, and people have to figure out where they fell. You know, were they in the list? Were they not in the list? How did they get into the list next time? Politics drives it. Too often, that's the case, and that's why nationally only about 13% of the population believe that transportation investment decisions are made based on need over politics. 87% believe that politics are the key driving force. And it creates a trust gap. And this is why you've got here the state transportation improvement list, improvement program list from Arkansas. Most states have a couple hundred page list like this. And there's nothing in here that would tell me why cash bypass deserves to get $50 million. Other than as a capacity expansion project, it costs a lot of money. And why does that receive money and nobody else receives money? Some states are really trying to open up the doors to how decisions are being made. And I think Virginia is really leading the way here. In 2014, with a very progressive governor and a very conservative House speaker, they passed unanimously a bill to really reform the way that they select their transportation projects to ultimately ensure that all projects are run through a criteria, objective criteria scoring matrix towards goals that are actually important to the system. You know, each of our transportation plans have goals, whether it be reducing emissions, increasing transportation options or access. But how do you actually go ahead and put those to the investments that are being
made? How do they score? How do they score them? Is there a point system?
Yeah. So these are the six criteria that came out of HB2. It's a very transparent process in terms of the website and how it's actually done. But each project receives a scorecard. And here you've got the project that received the number one score in the state. It's a project in rural Virginia, in Lynchburg, Virginia. It's a $150,000 project. It's ultimately going to improve a turn lane at a school so that people can better access the elementary school, but also provide a parking facility when they've got the max rush in the afternoon. So this is the project. But this is the scoring. They went ahead for a year and went and figured out working throughout the state to develop criteria to measure these projects. And so each of them have two, if not three, underneath them, and then they go ahead and rank each project to it. You can see here that the actual project benefit score in the middle is only 1.5. It's not that great. But I think what's really important for the way that Virginia is doing this, that some folks need to should be advised to look at, is that, you know, it's oftentimes we phase big projects. We do a little bit here and a little bit there, and that's going to be sitting on the STIP for the next 20 years taking money. And we need to figure out how to get these things going. What they ended up doing was making sure that the cost benefit of all these projects are of benefit and not just going to be big sucks for the money. And so they go ahead and at the end you get the score and you divide it by the amount of money that's being asked of by the state. So here you've got a $150,000 project being asked from the state, and they divide it by every 10 million. And so they get a score, project score of 100. That was the highest score in the state, and then they continue to go out from there. Mm-hmm. What I think is important to note, though, is that this doesn't necessarily mean that this is the way that the projects are going to be selected. This is a way to create some transparency and some understanding the way that the process works. These projects were scored and ranked and released in January. They had $6 billion worth of requests for $1 billion worth of dollars or funds available for capital construction. And so they went ahead and used this process. They're now going through the process of letting the discussion play out. You know, sometimes projects are that important that didn't score very well. So you guys would be able to work with outside stakeholders to be able to make decisions of is that project that important that it should come up in the ranking to get funded? But in order for it to happen, there has to be a description in a publicly deliverable way on a website so people understand why one project is that important to the elected leaders of the state in order for the project to receive funds. I think what's really important here is that they're not debating the actual scoring criteria and the process that's unplanned. They're actually now focusing in on the projects and the merits of the projects and receiving funds in ways that haven't been done before. I think that, you know, with what you guys have with Connect Oregon, you've got a ready-made example of a way that you can really kind of expand upon your ranking process, understanding that there was a little bit of a hiccup last year. But you can expand upon the process and the way that you go ahead and engage the public, create a highly transparent ranking score sheet, and you could do it across all of your projects, including Fix It and Enhance, if you guys were so to choose. Another one that I want to highlight for you is an innovative way that Massachusetts is using a very small pot of funds to try to ensure that local communities are achieving the outcomes that you guys set for policies for your state investments. I understand that you guys have had a complete streets policy on the books here for a long time. The big question is how you actually implement it, and are those designs coming through to the street projects to improve safety and access for all? Massachusetts went ahead and with $12.5 million is really kind of encouraging through funding, a limited amount of funds, encouraging folks to go ahead and implement complete streets policies at the local level. Then they're able, once they do that, they're able to receive $50,000 to do a local plan to prioritize projects and implement complete streets. And then after that's done, they then are eligible to receive $400,000 to go ahead and construct these projects that are on their prioritized list. And, you know, we work with the National Complete Streets Coalition, and I think that the success of this program is in the making of the report that they just released, where they ranked the top complete streets policies that have been adopted in the last year. And three of the top 10 were from the state of Massachusetts. So it's a way to use a limited, scarce amount of funds to go ahead and get to the outcomes that you guys are trying to get for the programs and the policies that you're setting. So that's kind of an overview of some policies that I think that could be of interest for you guys next year. I will say that I did spend a little bit of time here at the state capitol back in the day while I was in Eugene at school. This is a state that leads on transportation, you know, first with the gas tax, first with the VMT road usage charge program. But funding is not the only solution. You know, funding will not solve all your ills, and you need to ultimately look at the policies as well to make sure that you're getting and providing the accessibility and the transportation options for your constituents throughout the country. And there's different ways to do it. We're going to go ahead and you can join our policy network. You can join us in November. And then I'll also say that, like I said, we're going to go ahead and do a Fast Act briefing tomorrow in the state capitol where you're invited, your staff's invited. We'd love for you to come and learn more about that. But at the end of the day, the decisions where the rubber hits the road really are here at the state capitol. You've got big decisions ahead of you, and we're here to help.
So looking at the Virginia model, or I guess it could apply to any of those there. Oregon's system is largely a bottoms-up planning process. Mm-hmm. Does that parallel with what Virginia has? Is it just what they use at the local level to score?
So that's a good question. Virginia is a little bit different, I think, in terms of the control of the program. Virginia's DOT maintains and operates and constructs most of the roadways. That said,
including city streets?
Not all city streets, but most of the federal and some of the city streets, yes. But that said, they went ahead and redid all of their formula allocations last year. And in the process, they went ahead and 45% is going to maintenance, 40%, I can't remember exactly. I'll get the answer to you. But about 40% is going to statewide significance, and the rest is going to regional state highway districts. And those state highway district dollars actually have to run through the criteria process at the state level as well. Now, they get to go ahead and do the same process to change and shift funds if they so choose, but it's got to be done in a transparent and objectively driven manner.
And who sets the point values?
The state DOT did it in cooperation with the state legislature. They've got a transportation commission, not all too different from here. And then they did it in collaboration with all of the state and local leaders, stakeholders, local leaders throughout the state over a year-long process. And so, like I said, they rolled this out in January, and there hasn't been much debate in terms of the actual process and the scoring and the ranking. The question now, and it's really been quite diplomatic in terms of, will one project come up in one fall? But it's going to be done in a way that's not commonly found in many states.
Who does the scoring?
The state DOT.
Even on the regional projects?
Yes.
Hmm. So are regional projects scored first there and then submitted to the state?
They are submitted at the same time. And if they are deemed to be statewide significance, then they're deemed in a separate pot. If they're more of a local project, then they are scored through the local pot against their peers.
Hmm. And how do they deal with preservation and maintenance?
So, like I said, they went ahead and passed a bill this last year that went ahead and changed their formula program. So they have an operations and maintenance budget, which is the lion's share of their program. But then they go ahead and have a capital maintenance, which is about 45% of their capital side dollars. And then the rest goes through HB2. I've been informed by their DOT deputy secretary that there will not be any capital construction expansion project, new lanes, new transit, new multimodal surface transportation projects that don't roll through HB2 criteria.
Questions?
I want to thank you for last week. I really enjoyed D.C. and I learned a lot. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, it was good. It was good to be next to those folks. They're real smart. And, I hope that there were some lessons to take away.
It was pretty comprehensive. So,
well, thank you very much, Joe.
Thank you very much for having me.
Appreciate you coming out.
Yeah.
And Patrick. Is that it?
I think that completes our work for today, Mr. Chair. Although we'll see some of you tomorrow.
We will.
Yes.
As we start talking about transportation again.
Yes. And Friday and
anything
several
else
times
for the good of the order, gentlemen?
Yep.
We are adjourned.
Yep.
We are adjourned. Gentlemen?